Dear Father, I want to echo what has already been said this morning, that we recognize that you are a sovereign God. You're the one who is in control of everything. The events that happen to us throughout our life don't come as a surprise to you. The way things work out, while they certainly surprise us, they happen exactly the way that you want them to. And I'm thankful that that gives us cause for thankfulness, for submission, for love. Also, as we'll find out, it gives us cause for joy, because you alone are the one who can wrap all those things up, can have them all in your hand, and nothing happens that is not the way you want it to. And so thank you that we can come to a God like that this morning. Thank you that we can think about a God who is like that this morning. Please help us to do that in a way that is consistent with your word. And as we leave here this morning, please help us to be doers who remember what your word says and not just forgetful hearers. Thank you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. I asked this question in Sunday school several weeks ago, and I got the two responses that I thought that I would, so I think I will probably get them here this morning also. But when you get a book from the library, is there anybody here who goes to the last chapter first to see how it turns out and reads that chapter first? Is there anybody who will admit to doing that? Okay, I hold my hand up, all right? I don't know if you remember those books when I was younger. You had all the little different paths you could choose. I would go to the end and find the one that I wanted and try to backtrack my way through there to see if I could figure out how to get to the end that I wanted. All right, other side of the spectrum, how many of you, what I just said is like capital punishment? Okay, all right, well, don't stone me, because you do see that we've turned to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And yes, there are only 12 chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes, so yes, that does mean that we're going to be starting at the end. When I found out that I would be speaking a couple times, I was in a bit of a conundrum, a bit of a mental not knowing what to do. I didn't know exactly how many times I was going to be speaking. I didn't know if I should try to just do one thing each time that I speak, or go to a book and try to talk about that book. I just wasn't sure which way to go. The one thing that I could remember in my mind thinking was, keep it simple, keep it small. All right, something that you can tackle in whatever time or amount of time that you have to be able to speak. And just like the driver who sees that sign that says, road out, flooded, but yet proceeds on down that road, and we end up seeing them as that car washed down, the river that's overflowed the road. I ignored my own advice, and I said, let's tackle Ecclesiastes. The other thing that was going through my mind was how can I connect this to what Pastors Denny and Mike have been speaking in the book of Matthew. And last week, as Pastor Denny was finishing up, he finished in a very good place. Let me just read Matthew 16, where Denny finished last week. Matthew 16, 26 says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done." And you're in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Look at Ecclesiastes 12, verses 9 and 10. I'm sorry, go to verses 13 and 14, the very end. That's what we're starting with. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." That same theme, that same concept of God's judgment, of God's evaluation of every person in this world having to stand before that God as the eternal judge, was in both Matthew 16 and really throughout all of Ecclesiastes. Yes, I went to the end of the book here, but really that theme is found throughout the book. What we'll see as we not necessarily go through the book, because we're not going to have time for that, but really hopefully just take a bird's eye view of it, like an airplane flying over, see the different themes, see the different things that are in there. One of them is this recurring concept of the fear of the Lord, of God evaluating us and what it means to live in light of that. At times it will seem, I think, like Solomon is a bit of a broken record. what happens when that when a needle on a record gets stuck. Well, does everybody know what a record is? Okay. I'm dating myself, unfortunately. It gets stuck. It keeps saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. And Solomon does that for us too. He takes us down several paths and looks at those different paths with different pictures and poems and experiences that he has experienced, and tells us what he has found out, and always brings us back to this: the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Now, I don't know what your familiarity with the book of Ecclesiastes is. Maybe when Denny said that we were going to read it, you had to, you know, go back and look through the table of contents and remind yourself where the book of Ecclesiastes is. Maybe you're very familiar with it. But I wanted to remind you of some of the familiar passages that may have worked their way into our minds, and we may not have necessarily even known that they came from Ecclesiastes. If you're looking for a good verse about friendship, companionship, having a partner who works with you, Ecclesiastes 4:9 says this: two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. Two people working together can get more done than two people apart. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. If you're working, if you're being attacked, it's better to have someone with you, helping you. You might have heard one of those phrases before. One of the familiar phrases that Pastor Mike has mentioned several times is found in chapter 7 and verse 2. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it all to heart. If we have the choice between going to a funeral or to a party, the writer recommends to us going to that funeral, because then our end is held up there in front of our eyes, and we should consider how that causes us to live now. Again, if you are of a certain age, Ecclesiastes 3 was made into a folkish type song a while ago, and as I read those words, that tune may come to your head, and I apologize for that. But Ecclesiastes 3:1-3 says, for everything there is a season, time for matter, every matter under heaven, time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, and so on and so forth for those first eight verses. I would point out that the words turn are never found in there, and so the biblical nature of that song, I would say it's not biblical. However, those words go through our minds as we read if you've heard it go through our minds if we read Ecclesiastes chapter 3. If you're more of a fatalistic sort, that is, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, Ecclesiastes 11, verse 3 might be for you. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. That's just what they do. It's going to happen. It happens. If a tree falls to the south or to the north in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. Can't move a tree once it falls, unless you've, you know, got tools to be able to move it. But if a tree falls, there it lies. And then if you're a student and you maybe want to be able to go back to your teacher this week and say, this is what I learned this Sunday. Well, you're in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Look at verse 12. Here's what you can tell your teacher tomorrow when they ask you, what did you learn at church on Sunday? Verse 12, my son, beware of anything beyond these. Of the making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. So you can tell your teacher, I'm tired, I don't need to learn anymore. And then let me know how that goes. All right, so these are possibly some of the familiar verses that you might have heard from the book of Ecclesiastes. There are also a certain section of the verses that kind of make you say, am I allowed to say that? Or what does the writer quite mean by that? They are the verses that are referred to as the enjoyment of life verses. You know, we read chapter 1, and as Denny mentioned in his prayer, there's a lot of, you kind of come away, you know, maybe frustrated or sensing something dismal going on there. But that's not all throughout Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 2:24 says, there's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. really, that's the best thing for me. That's what it says. Chapter 3 again says, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful, to do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. You can see why these are called the enjoyment of life passages. Chapter 8, verse 15 says, I commend joy, for man has no good thing under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. So if you just focus on those verses, you can see why some have interpreted the book as meaning nothing more than eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. That's all there is, seize the day. And we'll come back to that section of verses in a little bit. But then there's also a section of verses that very much go along with what we read in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. You could call them the not very encouraging verses. Chapter 3, verse 19, what happens to the children of man and what happens to animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. Man has no advantages over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. In keeping with that, chapter 9 and verse 3 says, this is an evil that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of children of man are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. That's kind of morbid. What's with this preoccupation with death? Hopefully I'll be able to answer that. Now, depending on your background, again, any study you've done in Ecclesiastes, you probably know that it has been interpreted with a wide range of meanings. If you focus on those enjoyment of life passages, it becomes a book that tells you just how to enjoy the things that God has given us, and that's a good thing. If you just focus on these end-of-life passages or on these toil passages, it seems kind of a depressing study, a study that, we get up in the morning wanting to be encouraged by God's word, but you focus on those verses, and it's kind of like, that's not very encouraging. If you have a study Bible on your laps this morning, I may very well say something that doesn't agree with how that writer understands the book of Ecclesiastes, because it's been interpreted with a wide range of meanings. One of those reasons is because it fits into what we call the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. Do you remember what other books fit into that type of literature? We have Ecclesiastes. There's also Job, Proverbs, Song of Solomon would fit into that also. The wise men were people that were given by God to the people in the Old Testament to take God's law and apply it to their everyday situations. But they didn't always apply it to the everyday situations in ways that made it like immediately understandable. You can think about different examples in Proverbs. For example, in Proverbs it says, don't answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Do you remember what the very next verse says? Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Back and forth, you have these opposite. Which ones am I supposed to do? What the writer is doing is showing us these different paths that he's going to go down, where he's trying to answer the question that he seeks to answer. And with each one of those, he brings us back to the same place. Just like that record player that's stuck, the writer seems like that over and over and over again. Some people who have interpreted the book have called the writer a practical atheist. They look at those enjoyment of life passages and see that nothing other than, kind of just the musings of someone who has forgotten God, who might say that he knows God but hasn't applied God to his everyday living. And so then, therefore, those enjoyment of life passages don't really have anything to teach us for today. They say that the only truth that we can find is here at the end of the book in verses 13 and 14 of chapter 12. So the question then is there anything positive? Is there anything that a follower of God can learn from and live by as a result of studying what this book teaches? I do believe that there is, and hopefully I'll be able to share that with you. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and go through My aim is to look at verses 1 through 11, because really 1 through 11 are the introduction to the whole book. And anytime we come to a new book of the Bible, it's always good to step back and ask, who wrote it? Why did he write it? What was he trying to say? Who did he write it to? And so in answer to the question, who is the author of the book of Ecclesiastes, we're told in verse 1, this is the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. That's further explained in verse 12, where the writer says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. So the writer is someone who identifies himself, first of all, as a preacher, someone who is the son of David, someone who has been king in Jerusalem. The word that has translated preacher there is the Hebrew word kohelet. And some translations now simply put kohelet in there instead of preacher. It's not a specific name. It actually refers to someone who assembles people together, who goes out and gathers people for the purpose of teaching them. The most common translation that we see today is the one that we see here in our version, preacher. It has also been translated as, I got ahead of myself, it has also been translated as philosopher, guide, or teacher. In other words, the writer of the book is not specifically named. That has led some, and also because of some of the language that is used throughout the book, that's led some to say that the writer is actually anonymous, that it was written much later than any of the sons of David could have lived, and so it was not necessarily that a son of David sat down to write it, but that some narrator later on took the words of a son of David and put them together into what we know as Ecclesiastes. On the other hand, and as I believe, the writer of Ecclesiastes is Solomon. It's an interesting discussion looking into whether it was written at a time when Solomon was lived or whether it wasn't. Not really for our purposes today, but I do find the evidence compelling that it is Solomon. And we're going to look a little bit back in 1 Kings at what Solomon, at who Solomon was. But before we go there, the title of the book itself, Ecclesiastes, is not a title that the author picked. Ecclesiastes is the, it may sound familiar to you, it's from the Greek word that we get that refers to us as a church. You know, the church in the New Testament is not a building, it's an assembly or a group of people, and that Greek word is the ekklesia. So the Greek translation of the one who assembles people is Ecclesiastes. That's where we get the title from. All it means is the one who assembles. Now, you may or you may not know much about King Solomon, who Solomon was. Let's go back to 1 Kings and see, let's see who he was and what we can learn about him a little bit before diving more into the book. So 1 Kings chapter 3, please. 1 Kings chapter 3. And look at, let's start in verse 3. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father. Only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart towards you. You have kept for him this great and steadfast love and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David, my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this, and God said to him, "Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but instead have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and a discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you will arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. If you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." And Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. He came to Jerusalem and stood before the ark of the covenant of the Lord and burnt and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. Solomon was not the oldest son of David. Normally, when you think of a king and you know the monarchy passing on to the next, the oldest son, Solomon was not that oldest son. In fact, there are about 20 sons of David that are actually named in the Old Testament. And at one point, prior to 1 Kings chapter 3, there was another one who had gathered enough support to become king after David. David had not chosen a king yet, and another of his sons was working to do that. However, you notice Solomon's recognition of God's sovereignty in verse 7 that we read there, when he said, "O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father." The sovereignty of God is a theme that we will see woven throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon recognized who God is and the fact that he is in control of everything. Solomon was ultimately chosen by David to be king because the prophet Nathan came to David and said that was God's will for David to do, to set Solomon up as king. You remember Nathan's role in David's life. Nathan was the prophet who confronted David after his sin with Bathsheba, the murder of Bathsheba's husband. And we see in the Psalms that David wrote after that occasion how David responded to that interaction with Nathan. He repented. Nathan stayed at his side for David's entire reign. And it was actually Nathan's advice, God through Nathan, that caused David to put Solomon up as the king. And thinking about Solomon being raised by David, what was David's, if you want to say nickname, what was the name that he went by? Not the name that he went by. What do we know him by? The man after God's own heart. I would have to assume that in some way that knowledge of God was passed from David onto his sons. He wrote the Psalms, those Psalms Solomon would have had as he was growing up. This is where Solomon would have gotten his recognition of the fear of the Lord from, of who God was, and everything that he needed to know about the Mosaic Law, about who God was, that would have come from his father David. Another interesting thing to think about Solomon as king was that we have the promise in Genesis 3:15 that God would ultimately crush the serpent's head, but that person that everyone was looking for, that his heel would be bruised. Another connection to the book of Matthew that we've been going through is the fact that Solomon is listed in that genealogy of going all the way up to Jesus. And at that time, really, the person in the monarchy was looked to by the people as possibly that person fulfilling that role of being that one who is going to crush the head of the serpent. But ultimately, just like David proved, because he was sinful, he was not that person. And even as we read here a little bit, even though Solomon asked for wisdom, there are a few things in there where Solomon shows that he doesn't follow God in everything. The people might have been looking at Solomon like he was that one, but ultimately we come to see that he was not that one, and we need to continue looking elsewhere. So we've seen that Solomon understands that God is sovereign. Solomon also understands the value of wisdom, and that was what he asked God for. God gave him wisdom, but then God also gave him wealth. Let's look a little bit at the wealth of Solomon. Go over to 1 Kings chapter 4 and look at verse 20. 1 1 Kings 4 and verse 20. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. Now, I don't measure anything by core. You might. I did not know what a core was. 30 cores of fine flour works out basically to about 1,500 gallons, 1,500 dry gallons of flour. If Solomon's kingdom stretched from the Euphrates to everywhere that this passage indicates, he would have had people in that whole area who would have needed fed every day. And the amount of the food that was needed when it came to flour was about 1,500 gallons of flour. Verse 23, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelle, roebucks, and fatted fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifshah to Gaza, over the kings west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. It wasn't just that he had food to feed those who served him. He also had a massive army. Verse 26, Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon for all who came to King Solomon's table, each one in his month. They let nothing be lacking. Barley also and straw for the horses, swift steeds, they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman, Chalcol and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon and to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And people of all the nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And that's a lot to read, but I wanted to remind us of what the life of King Solomon was like, because when we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, we see that Solomon tells us that he looked at everything under the sun. Solomon had wealth that was truly unfathomable, wealth that I can't even imagine. And he at various points in his life, he used that wealth to seek out the answers that he was looking for. There aren't many people who could say that they searched everything under the sun, because we just don't have the resources that Solomon did. But he had them, and he put them into this quest that he's going to take us on. What was the name of the queen who heard about his fame from afar and came and visited him? The Queen of Sheba. Later on in 1 Kings, it tells us that what she saw couldn't even, you know, measure up to everything that she had heard. It was so much better. It actually took her breath away. We're told that Solomon had wealth that allowed him to make a throne of ivory. Ivory now is illegal, obviously, but it wasn't that throne of ivory, as if that wasn't enough, building a throne out of ivory, he covered it with gold. You know, ivory was the foundation for it. Gold was what covered it. He used the wealth that God provided him to build the temple. Up to the point that Solomon was king, God had not had that temple in Jerusalem for his people to worship him at, because David had been a warrior, and God said, I want your son to build it for me. So Solomon used his wealth to build that temple. And when you read about all the wealth that was used in building that temple, it's not just impressive, it's overwhelming. And Solomon recognized that all that wealth came from God. You know, we're told that he built a house for himself. But he didn't just stop with building a house for himself. He built a house for his wife, for all of his wives. We're told that he had 700 wives, 300 concubines. His empire was greater than I can even imagine. The silverware in his house was not made out of silverware. was not made out of silver. You know, we call the stuff that we use silverware. I'm not sure if any of it actually is. Okay, all right. In Solomon's house, the silverware was actually called goldware. His utensils were all made out of gold because silver was as plentiful as stones in all of Israel. That's how wealthy he was. And at times, you know, thinking about 700 wives and 300 concubines, Solomon disobeyed God's law and went down paths that took him places. You know, we're told at the end of his life, all those wives took his heart away from God and instead focused him on the idols from the different countries that he came from. But again, he used that wealth to take us down a path in Ecclesiastes that hopefully, you know, he's coming to the end of his life. He's looking at the different things that he's done, and he's saying, here is what I've learned. And so hopefully we can learn what he is trying to teach us. So if you would, please turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And we see in chapter 1, verse 3, the ultimate question that Solomon is setting out to answer for us. The ultimate question that Solomon is setting out to answer for us, chapter 1, verse 3 says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Another way to ask that same question would be, you know, what's the meaning to life? What's the purpose to life? You know, I go to work. Depending on where your work is, you go to work, but what's the point to all of this? Why is it that I am doing all of this? And the word that Solomon uses to answer that question is found in chapter 2, right before it, verse 2, right before it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So in answer to the question, what's the purpose of life, Solomon answers, vanity. That helps, right? It's going to help us if we define what the word vanity means. The Hebrew word is the Hebrew word hevel, and there is no one English word that completely translates that Hebrew word from its original language into our English language, and so it has provided a range of meanings. Listen to some of the words that people have used to translate this word vanity. Meaninglessness, uselessness, absurd, futility, bubble, trace, or transience. Usually when we think of the word vanity, we think of someone who's conceited, you know, who thinks of themselves more highly than they ought. That's not really the definition of the word vanity that goes along with those who have picked the word vanity for this chapter, this book. Vanity also can mean empty, you know, fleeting, and that is perhaps the meaning that they were trying to get at. This word is the theme of the book. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, he ends with the same statement, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He starts with it here. It's used 73 times in the Old Testament, and 38, over half of those times, are used here in Ecclesiastes. So understanding what it means is really the key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes. Literally, that word hevel means breath or vapor. Breath or vapor. Breath of breaths, all is breaths. Again, in Hebrew, when something is said to be vanity of vanities, they are meaning to say that it is the best of anything. We think of the Holy of Holies, and that is the most holy place in the temple. We also think of the phrase King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There is no king or lord who is above God. So he is saying, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This is the most of vanity that you can get out of it. It means breath, it means vapor. But figuratively, it also has a definition that means pointless, fruitless, or of no value. And I think you experienced that some as we read through chapter 1. You know, the sun rises, the sun goes down, it hastens to the place where it rises. What's the point? If we look at those definitions that I've mentioned up to this point, we do come away with a purely negative meaning for this word, though. It doesn't seem like there's anything positive that we could take away from that. And so there are another group of words that would define, that define hevel, and they have to do with puzzling, incomprehensible, or a frustrating puzzle. I don't know how many of you like to do, 1,000-piece puzzles. That's not really on my list of things that I, really love doing, because puzzles do become somewhat frustrating for me. I prefer the ones that are like 4 pieces, and they're all corners, because that's the first thing you look for is the corners. I got the corners. So if I have a 4-piece puzzle, I get the 4 corners, and I've got it figured out. That idea of puzzling is really the idea that Solomon wants us to think of when he uses this phrase, all is vanity, all is puzzling. But it's not just puzzling like in a sort of way. It's puzzling in a frustrating sort of way, because life at times is frustrating. That's one of the words that Denny mentioned as he was praying. There's no denying that life is frustrating. It's a frustrating puzzle. You might be making your breakfast in the morning and you want cinnamon and sugar toast. I don't know if any of you eat cinnamon and sugar toast, but you go up to the shelf to reach for that bottle of ground cinnamon, and instead you grab the bottle of ground red pepper. I'm not sure why the bottle of ground red pepper is next to the bottle of ground cinnamon, but it happens to be there. Some days you catch your mistake before you put it on the bread. Some days you don't. Life can be a frustrating puzzle. Now, that's a rather small example. We can move up from there to think about the frustrations that go on at work. You know, you've worked hard, you're next in line for a promotion, and you end up not getting it because, someone in HR owed a favor to someone in finance. And so instead of you getting that promotion, someone who is not working as hard as you, someone who doesn't deserve it, gets that promotion. We can think about health and, just the different diseases that those who follow God become afflicted with. It can become a frustrating puzzle. We'll see that Ecclesiastes does teach us that not only life is a gift from God, but he's also going to teach us how we can enjoy life even in the midst of those frustrating puzzles. 3 things that we can think about life and helping us to understand this word, if I could just say it, that life is a frustrating puzzle. First of all, life is elusive. Life is elusive. We can't control it. One of the ways that Solomon describes vanity of vanities is down in verse 14, and he uses it again in verse 17. In verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. You see the phrase again in verse 17, striving after wind. That word striving can also be translated as shepherding. Can anybody shepherd the wind? What kind of a task is that? That's a wearisome task that cannot actually be done. We're in the midst of hurricane season. If there was some way that the wind could be shepherded, we would have figured it out by now, but we can't shepherd the wind. Life is elusive. We can't control it. And that kind of gets down to the point of asking the question, what's the point? Because if we can figure out what's the point, then maybe we can control it. But Solomon's going to tell us life is not about controlling it. In the midst of these frustrating puzzles of life, our goal is not to control it. Our goal is going to be, as the title that I put at the top of your notes, if you're using that, is to live life backward, to consider what the end of life is, to consider the different things that God has given us to enjoy in our life as we go through it, and not necessarily to control it, but to live life on God's rules, under God's standards, in the way that he wants us to live by. So life is elusive. We can't control it. That's one aspect of helping us understand how life can be a frustrating puzzle. And that's a familiar theme in the book, in the whole Bible. James 4 says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. You can't grab at mist. You can't grab at a vapor and say you have got it. Life is elusive. Ultimately, we can't control it. But not only is life elusive, life is short. We can't make it any longer. And here again is that theme of death that Solomon continually brings us back to. He doesn't bring us back to that theme of death for the purpose of discouraging us, but for reminding us that everyone has the same end in life. For all of the quests and searches and voyages that have gone on for, you know, to try to find that fountain of life, no one's found it. No one's going to find it, because everyone lives and everyone dies. Life is short. We can't make it any longer. And no matter what point we are at in our lives, there's always someone older who would be looking back and saying, the older you get, you know, the more you realize the shorter it is. When you're young, you're full of energy, you've got lots of plans, and that's great. Solomon says, remember that your end is the same end as everyone, and at that end, everything you've done, it will be evaluated. God is the great judge, and he will evaluate that all. Life is short. No matter how hard we try, we can't make it any longer. Putting these two together, life is elusive and life is longer. One example I came across was had to do with the founder of Apple, Steve Jobs. I don't know how many of you like Apple devices, but if you know anything about Steve Jobs, he was very meticulous, very smart. But about 5 years before he died, he started designing his own yacht. He really liked yachts, and he started designing his own yacht, only it wasn't like yacht like we think of, like Menor Harbor Yacht Club. It was a yacht that was about three-quarters the length of a football field. And he got to design every single little aspect of that yacht. It was exactly the way that he wanted it to be. In the end, it ended up costing almost $100 million. Again, you think about the, Solomon's wealth, which was probably even greater than that. But, I mean, $100 million, that's unfathomable. But, he got to design every single little bit of it. But do you know when he took possession of it? Is this a familiar story to anyone? He took possession of it a year after he died. He couldn't stop the cancer that riddled his body, and he never got to enjoy this thing that he had spent so much time putting his time and his money and his effort into. It's now owned by his estate, by his family. Life is elusive. We can't control it. Life is short. We can't make it longer. But also, life is repetitive. We can't change it. And you notice that repetition as we went through the first 11 verses of chapter 1. I don't mean that we can't change it by we're not supposed to try to change the circumstances that we're in, or we're not supposed, you know, we're just supposed to throw up our hands and say whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But what I mean is there are things that we truly cannot change. The sun rises, the sun goes down, it hastens to the place where it rises. Wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, around and around goes the wind. As on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. There's just this constant repetition, this cycle. I go to bed, I get up, I go to work, I come home, I go to bed, I get up, I go to work, I come home. Maybe you've done that cycle for a long time in your life, and now you're at the point of retirement, so you go to bed. You get up. You have more to do now than what you had to do when you went to work. You do that. You come home. You go to bed. You get up. You do what it is you're supposed to do. You come home. You go to bed. You get up. It's repetitive. It goes on, and we can't change it. And Solomon at no point tells us that the point or the purpose of life is to change it. That's not the goal. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to enjoy life in light of the God who's there. That's the reason I read those enjoyment of life passages, and we'll get into those in some other weeks as we go forward. But there is a way in which we are able to enjoy what God has given us in this life, and the way we do that is by living in light of the God who's there. That phrase comes from a friend of mine who preached through Ecclesiastes, and I was really searching for a brief way to try to sum up what the theme of Ecclesiastes was, and it's simply to live life in light of the God who's there. There's a Latin phrase, you may have heard it, it's coram Deo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but that's to live life in the face of God. Again, Solomon recognized the sovereignty of God. He recognized that there was nothing that happened that was outside of the control of God. He knew where his wealth came from. He knew that one day he would ultimately answer to that God. And he understood that you could enjoy the things that God gives us in this life if we enjoy them in the way that God wants us to enjoy. Verse 7 said, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. You know, living along Lake Erie, you can drive or, take a boat along the edge of Lake Erie and see all the places where different rivers come in, different streams come in. The Grand River is close to us in Fairport. You have the Chagrin River, the Cuyahoga River, and that water just keeps coming and coming and coming, and the lake never fills up. The water goes up, it comes down, it goes around. All things, he says in verse 8, are full of weariness. They're so tiring that we can't utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear is filled with hearing. You know, it just keeps going. And Ecclesiastes will help us understand how to have joy in the midst of that going and going and going and going. Look, if you would, please, with me at Matthew chapter 12. Because, again, there's a connection we have here with the book of Matthew that we've been going through. Matthew 12, and look at verse 41. The men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment of this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south, queen of Sheba, will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. So we have that line starting in Genesis 3:15, going through David, going through Solomon, and where does that line ultimately end? In the person and work of Jesus Christ. If we're going to live life on God's terms, the very first step is coming to him on his terms through the person and work of Jesus Christ. As Chad mentioned as we were singing this morning, if we bring anything to God as proof of why he should accept us, of why we are in a right relationship with him, if that's what we do, we have never started in on a right relationship with God. It only comes through our right relationship with Jesus Christ. And Solomon ultimately points us there because he talks about the fear of God. And ultimately, you can't fear God if you never come to him through Jesus Christ. For believers, look over at Philippians chapter 4. There is a way in which Ecclesiastes will tie into what we as believers have learned in the book of Philippians also. Look at Philippians 4, 10 through 13. Part of living life on God's terms is reflected here in these verses. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. So Paul is speaking about those who at one point had no opportunity to help him financially, but now they do. And he says in verse 11, not that I am speaking of being in need. I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In each and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger and abundance and need. And what is that secret? In verse 13, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Our strength for living life the way God intended it comes from Christ strengthening us. Again, it comes from being rightly related to God, and it comes from, as we've learned in Colossians in Sunday school, God in us. Something that Solomon ultimately didn't know anything about, because Paul calls that a mystery, something he didn't know about. But the strength to live life on God's terms comes through Christ in us. And when we rely on that strength, we are able to be content in whatever situation that we are in. God calls his followers, as he calls them to follow after him, you know, he never promises the pain, the frustration, the anxiety, the sicknesses, the illnesses to go away. I mean, in fact, Jesus promises quite the opposite. He says, all of my followers, if you follow me, you will suffer persecution. So the point is not to make those things go away. The point is to live in the midst of them in a way that pleases God. And Philippians 4:13 tells us that we can do that by doing all things through him who strengthens me. And so what I plan to do with the book of Ecclesiastes is go through and follow this progression, the way that Solomon tells us, explains to us this frustrating puzzle of life and what it means to live life in light of the God who's there, and see how that applies to us today. But we always need to remember that the only way we can be rightly related to God is coming to him through the person and work of Jesus Christ and relying on him to live with his strength in the way in which he calls us, in which he calls us to live. Let's pray. Dear God, I thank you that you are not dead, but you are alive. And I thank you that you are the one who strengthens us to live in a way that pleases you. Thank you again for the truth of your word. Thank you that we've been able to consider it. Please help us to obey it also, because without your strength, we cannot obey it. Thank you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.